Welcome to Business Frontiers in Malta, the program exploring the dynamic world of enterprise, innovation, and economic transformation. This series shines a light on startups and entrepreneurship, powerful forces reshaping how we live, work, and do business in Malta and beyond. From bold ideas to disruptive technologies, entrepreneurs are challenging the status quo and driving global change. We will explore what fuels their journey, how they scale, and the obstacles they face in today's competitive markets. Whether you are a founder, policymaker, investor, or just curious about the frontier of modern business, this series is for you. I am your host, Professor Anne-Marie Take, from the Department of Policy, Politics and Governance, and we are broadcasting from the university's radio station, Campus 103.7. On today's program, we'll be talking with our special guest, Mr. Brian Zarpadami, CEO and co-founder of CyberSift, diving into the topic CyberSift, redefining cybersecurity through AI and Maltese innovation. So stay tuned because you won't want to miss a moment. With 28 years of senior ICT management experience, Brian Zarpadami is CEO at CyberSift, a leading cybersecurity solutions provider. His dedication to innovation and R&D has resulted in products delivering immediate business value, positioning CyberSift prominently in the cybersecurity industry. Under his leadership, CyberSift is revolutionizing cybersecurity through advanced self-learning threat detection tools, simplifying IT security globally. Operating across 7 countries, namely Malta, Estonia, the UK, Poland, Bulgaria, Cyprus, and Greece, CyberSift's multinational team collaborates effectively across 3 time zones, united by a mission to combat cyber threats and foster innovation, collaboration, and robust digital security. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you.
So, Brian, take us back to 2017. What inspired you to start CyberSift, and what gap did you see in the cybersecurity landscape at the time?
First of all, thank you for having me. At the time, cybersecurity wasn't something that was as in vogue as it is today. You know, nowadays, you just turn on the TV or look at the papers, and almost every week somebody has been hacked, some breach or something has happened. At the time, it wasn't so prominent. The inspiration actually came from a previous role I had. I was the chief technology officer in a company that did medical software. In fact, one thing that I don't have in my bio almost anymore is that by training I'm a pharmacist, so I come from the medical field. And luckily, I met a local company, a local CEO, that wanted to grow an outfit, a software company that was doing software for hospitals. In fact, the biggest customer we had was the NHS. We had a system that basically used to manage patient files, patient records, using RFID. And our idea was to help these NHS hospitals, some of which are the size of our towns in Malta, with the management of these patient files. You know, one particular hospital near Manchester used to see a couple of million patients a year. So imagine the patient files moving around all the time, you know, in the hospital. Some for a relatively easy procedure like appendicitis. Others are traveling around the hospital because the patient has a cancer or something. So even when you want to digitize those files, you'd actually start with those that are, you know, the frequent flyers, I call them, the ones moving around. So on a fine day in another hospital, in a London hospital, I am there having my break, you know, in the hospital canteen. And I see this nurse, you know, with this little girl in tow. And the little girl had a bandana on, you know, no hair, obviously some chemotherapy, some probably cancer case. And the nurse was carrying the patient file, you know, with the name of the hospital and all. And up in the corner, I see our RFID tag that is basically, you know, monitoring the whereabouts of this patient file. One of the things our system used to do was location-based filing, right? So you scan the file, you scan a location, And then the system knows where the file is. It's no longer like you'd have in a library, alphabetical or by author or by something. You know, it's literally location. If the system goes down, you've basically lost the location of those millions of records. And I started, you know, it was like the oh wow moment, the typical eureka type thing. You know, I wasn't in a bot at the time, fair enough. But I said, my God, if you know, the system, you know, gets hacked or something, that poor girl is not going to get her treatment. And I went back, you know, and it was always at the back of my mind. Later on, the same company got authorization to link our office in Malta, and we had an office in Macedonia as well, and we could link directly to the wide area network of the NHS, of the hospitals, one of the few companies out of the UK that was allowed to do it. But the NHS told us, you need to have a security operations centre for us to allow you on. Security operations centre, as in, we don't want to get hacked because you get hacked as a supplier, you know. And then all of a sudden, you know, everything fell into place for me. You know, I said, ah, okay, so this is my cue to up our security here in the company. You know, obviously, when you're developing software, it's one thing. You know, obviously, you want to make it secure by design. But all of a sudden, you're elevating yourself to a higher calling. At the time, we used to use a third-party tool, which was completely manual. You know, it was a type of software that would try to match a scenario with something it has in its database, quite clunky, you know, and very expensive. And we actually became a reseller of this product locally. We also installed it, you know, had some big projects with it, but projects used to take 8 months, and by the end of it, you know, the customer needs an army of people to manage it, which was ridiculous. A colleague of mine was doing his master's at the University of Liverpool and told me, listen, there's this up-and-coming thing called machine learning. We should apply machine learning to this type of detection to see what's going on. And I said, look, David is my co-founder. I told him, let's build a prototype and let's see what happens. And he built this prototype. We took it to the board of directors of the company we worked for. And we were told, listen, well done, but, you know, we are basically going to sell this company. They were in the final throes of receiving an offer from a Scottish company. Don't invent anything new. You know, let's see if this actually sale goes through. If it does, good luck to you. You have an idea there. Go for it, you know. And that's how CyberSift actually started. So we had this use case. We had this idea, you know, we wanted to make cybersecurity faster. And we applied at the beginning machine learning to this problem.
This is very interesting, Brian. You mentioned a number of things. Maybe we could explain what they are.
Sure.
For the sake of our listeners. You made reference to FRID. Can you explain what this means?
RFID. It is basically using a radio frequency tag. So RF, radio frequency, ID, identification. What they actually are little chips that you can put on an item, right, on an asset. In this case, it was a patient file. But if you go shopping, most apparel nowadays, inside the label, you'll find an RFID tag. In the context of retail, they use it for inventory control and pricing and whatnot. In the context of anything else, you know, hospital and so on, it's inventory management, right? So you're, in this case, we're doing it on patient files, but there are use cases where you're doing it on medical equipment or factory equipment and so on. The whole idea is, you know, you don't want to have a clinic and your patient is there, but the file is God knows where, you know. So the system used to understand where the clinics are, make sure the files arrive, you know, on time, and you just have these kind of automations in okay. Build.
And when you talked about this idea that you wanted to implement it, has Malta benefit from this?
Maltese organizations, I would say for sure, because predominantly our customer base is local. I would say 80% of our customers are Maltese and Maltese financial institutions, and a couple of healthcare also. abroad, they seem more open to and amenable to implement such tools.
Okay. So what was the biggest challenge you faced in transforming your research background that you talked about into a commercial product?
Look, coming up with a proof of concept is usually quite easy. What I mean by quite easy, you know, you can easily, you know, have a black screen with text coming up and you're proving a point, right? So you have some algorithm working in the background and it's giving you a result. But a customer doesn't want that. They want the polish. They want the front end. They want the dashboards. They want the report. They want the user management, you know, this kind of thing. So the biggest leap for us was, okay, we know it works, but now how are you going to package it? And that was the hardest thing. And now, almost 8 years on, we are revamping it to the nth degree. Now we have the product at a point where the first line analyst is no longer a human being, but another AI. So you know, when an anomaly is detected, you know, the AI takes over, actually goes in and does its whole triage as though it were a person. It writes up a report, creates a ticket for the customer, creates a ticket for a second liner, and then the human takes over from there.
For our listeners, can you walk us through so that they can understand what you mean by AI agents?
Initially, we were talking about machine learning, right? Which is, let's say, a subset of AI. And most of those algorithms are based on statistics. And you know, there are the various ones that there's loads of literature about, right? Bayesian statistics and so on. The way we work is, first you try to look for an anomaly. An anomaly being an outlier. So if you had to plot a graph, and let's say Brian is logging in every day at 9 o'clock, Monday to Friday, but all of a sudden he's logging into the office network on a Saturday at 5 p.m., that last logon is an outlier, anomaly. What the system will do then is, once it identifies that as an anomaly, it does threat detection. It starts asking these 29 threat sources that we have. Various international vendors, but they're the big international IT security companies. And what we do is we say, listen, have you ever seen this outside, this external IP address in any of your databases? Has it ever been in a data breach? Has it ever been in an attack? Has it ever been part of a botnet or a part of a denial of service attack or something? Some come and say, yes, it's a known IP address and it belongs to Vietnam Hacking Group, whatever. Or it will be an unknown. So the anomaly can be just an anomaly. Brian had to work on Saturday. Or it can be an anomaly and a threat. We record all the activity. Why do we record the activity? Because, and I'll relate another story if we have a minute. We were asked to do a proof of concept for an American company who spend $1 million a year on security with an American firm. And our AI kept saying, listen, there's an anomaly with this user. And after a couple of weeks of this anomaly always popping up, we went back to the CTO at this American firm, and we told him, listen, we have a problem with this user because he's doing something strange. And he goes, you see, your AI doesn't even work. The guy hasn't worked for us, the employee hasn't worked for us for over 6 months. What it actually translated to was that, yes, he was no longer an employee. He had valid credentials, however, so nobody in HR informed IT to remove his username, password, and all. So where everybody, you know, 1,000 people were doing a Monday to Friday office hours, this person was logging in on a Friday night, actually using their infrastructure on one of these big cloud providers, using the infrastructure to mine for Bitcoin, and then on Sunday night, switching everything off, getting his Bitcoin or cryptocurrency, whatever he was doing, and logging off. In reality, that wasn't a threat per se, because he wasn't really hacking and he had a valid username, a valid password, and valid credentials. And also valid multi-factor authentication, by the way. So what it does is, it didn't come up as a critical alert, right? So it was just an anomaly. But when you're discussing the findings with your customer, some are threats and they're obvious and you have to block and do whatever. But then there are these side cases that in reality, this company was paying 200-300 euros a month worth of surveys when they shouldn't have been, you know, and there was a breakdown in the process where they didn't, you know, disable this person's account.
So the individual did not alert the company saying that I'm using
Of course not. He was using hundreds of dollars worth of infrastructure for free and making money off it, right? Profiting off it.
Okay, so isn't there that ethical issue there?
In fact, it's illegal. What he was doing was illegal. He should have relinquished his credentials, and if he was a good Samaritan, he should have told them. But he was taking that situation to his advantage, you know? So.
Exactly. Okay. We'll continue talking about AI. We have a few more questions on it, but let me just sort of continue understanding a little bit about your industry experience. Mm-hmm. I mean, you claimed that you are a pharmacist.
Mm-hmm. A long time ago.
Okay. How did your background shape CyberSift, you know, in terms of the technological direction?
Well, my story, I don't think, is unique. In fact, I know even a few doctors who are now in technology. What happened was that most of my family, nearly all, are in the medical field. I was kind of pushed there. You know, you're either a doctor, a pharmacist, or related. And I had started the pharmacy course. I enjoyed the pharmacy course. It was obviously here in Malta, the university where we are at right now. And in the last year, I realized I should have taken some kind of electronics engineering rather than remained in the pharmacy course, because I had already started my first IT business while I was in my last year at university. And the professor at the time told me, listen, if you're like, you know, IT and technology so much, why don't you build us some software that will help, you know, the pharmacy practice in Malta improve? And that was kind of a good marriage for me, you know, way back when. So this must have been 94. I built a point of sale system that would monitor for drug interactions while you're buying the products, right? It looks up the British National Formulary. And if you're buying warfarin and aspirin, you know, the pharmacist gets an alert on the screen, although the pharmacist would know, saying, hey, ask the patient if these are for the same person because they interact. And, you know, this was then extended to include patient medication records. And at the time, here we had MS-DOS, if you were as old as me, you remember, you know, black screen with white or green writing, and DBase. So there was no concept of multitasking or anything like that. But this went on to become a product. I had developed it with another software developer at the time who actually bought it over and kept it running as a company. And one particular pharmacy kept running the software for 18 years. So from 96, it was switched off not too long ago. Obviously, when he probably couldn't find any more parts for the poor computers, you know, it had to go. But, you know, IT was always a strong component of my life. Later on, I worked in the pharma business, and the local distributor wanted to get into biomedical engineering. So I ended up taking care of the ultrasound machines for them, which were basically Windows computers at the time. And then we had a line of pacemakers where I used to go to the cath lab at St. Luke's at the time and, you know, sitting on the programming of the pacemakers and so on. And, you know, slowly the devices and the IT took over until about 1999 when I left medicine completely and started my first IT company.
So was this a self-taught process?
Initially, it was self-taught. My uncle, who's also a pharmacist, was very much into IT as well. And, you know, I used to go to these summer courses and, you know, short courses about software programming at the time and that type of thing. Eventually, when I did it professionally, I got certified, you know, from different academies that there were, one of which was in the UK.
Okay. What would you say was your defining moment when you realized that CyberSift had the potential to scale beyond a research project into a fully fledged business?
Look, you never have a crystal ball, right? And hindsight is always 2020, you have a hunch. And in fact, it was a hunch because at the time, you know, when we used to talk to a potential investor, they think we're dreaming, you know, almost the opposite. But then when you start to realize how everything is getting connected and how, you know, a person sitting on the other side of the world with an internet connection can do harm, there must be some potential to it. And actually, you know, most of the world runs on Windows. And Windows is known to be a very insecure operating system. So there must be a business case out there, kind of thing. In fact, Microsoft in the last, almost, I would say, as old as cybersafety is, in the last 8 or so years, started to up its ante when it came to security. You know, before, it was worse than Swiss cheese, kind of thing.
Okay. So let's move on now to technology and innovation. CyberSIFT's platform is described as self-learning and inspired by the human neurological system. Can you explain how this concept translates into practical threat detection?
So, as you can imagine, it's a mixture of different technologies now. So there's machine learning that we've had for a while. Of late, we have also integrated these large language models, right? So we are leveraging, even for ease of explaining, the reasoning part of AI. And what the system does is, first it takes a baseline, it tries to understand the network. Then it looks for anomalies. And the more data it's ingesting, the finer the results it gives you at the end of the day. Generally, we tell the customers, listen, for the first week, ignore it, because it's like a hypertensive person, you know, every time you even touch it, it's going to react to something, so let it learn. Eventually, things settle down. It understands the patterns of what is normal and what isn't. And then it starts to alert on the anomalies it thinks it needs to highlight. The issue we have sometimes is that it comes up with things that you're left guessing as to why it decided it's an anomaly. You know, sometimes you really have to look at it from different angles for you to understand. It almost has a life of its own. I mean, if it weren't a machine and you know how it's put together, you'd start to wonder, oh my, what's going on here? But if I had to explain it in a different way, if you were to look at a map closely, close range, and you're looking at the topography for Malta, you're seeing Malta and you're just seeing the land, right? As soon as you zoom out, your context changes because all of a sudden you're seeing the ocean, you're seeing nearby countries, you're seeing other facets, right? Your situational awareness of the thing changes completely. And that is what the AI does, you know. So it has the power to process so much data at the same time that it comes up with inferences that if you don't look at almost at the same situation that it is, you'll miss it. You know, in fact, our analysts, the human analysts, sometimes think it's making mistakes, but actually, they're not reasoning in the same way.
Okay. So when we talk about, you know, this technology, you know, the LLM, the language...
Large language machine learning.
How does CyberSIFT, you know, use of these technologies, you know, differ from what is already on the market?
I wouldn't say that it differs. And I wouldn't say that we are completely unique. We're definitely unique at the price point we sell the product. So if you had to go in the market and look for solutions similar to ours, you're looking at 10 times the cost. What is definitely unique is the way we concatenate the algorithms, right? So one algorithm feeds the next until it comes up with a result. Very often you will find that other companies would choose one or two algorithms and that's it. We keep going and going and going. Others, I would say, focus more on the marketing side, you know, and they try to give the customer a feeling of buy my product and you're completely safe. we're a bit too much feet on the ground, you know. In fact, there is no solution that is infallible for cybersecurity.
Okay. So with cybersecurity, you know, threats seem to evolve very quickly. And how would you say CyberSift ensures its system continues to learn and adapt?
So we actually have an investor, right? And one of the questions that the investor asks is, so when will the development be finished? And the answer is never. Mm-hmm. In fact, we have our November is typically a business planning month, right? So you need to present your business plan to the board and all this stuff. And recurring, you know, the software development on the same products. And we do get the question kind of, when does it end? So it's a matter of understanding the current threats, seeing what happens in practice, and then putting those smarts into the product.
Okay. All right. So let us now take a short musical break and we'll continue discussing this point. But please stay tuned to Campus 103.7 to continue listening to the discussion on CyberSift, redefining cybersecurity through AI and Maltese innovation. Before we go, the following song.
Radio Waves by Roger Waters.
Brian, why did you choose it?
Well, I thought the title gave it away, right? We're talking about technology and all. This particular album is by one of the founders of Pink Floyd and was introduced to me by my English literature teacher when I was about 16 years old. And it's one of my earliest memories of hearing a synthesized voice. So it's very, let's say, AI of many, many years ago, right? And if you listen to the intro, you get this voice asking for a song, effectively.
This is KAOS. You and I are listening to Chaos in Los Angeles. Let's go to the telephones now and take a request.
Radio waves.
Welcome back to Business Frontiers in Malta with me, Anne-Marie Tech. My guest is Brian Zarpadami, CEO and co-founder on CyberSift. Now let us get back into the second part of the discussion. Brian, before the break, we talked about cybersecurity threats. How do you balance automation with human expertise when dealing with complex security incidences?
That's a difficult one. So, first of all, the threats are becoming very sophisticated. Very sophisticated. And what modern day attackers are doing is, I call it, they're gaming the system. So they are not, they're not noisy anymore, right? So you almost need to have like the horse whisperer kind of mentality when you're getting into this. There's no red light or no, you know, flashing screens anymore, nothing of that. So they're silent. Most of them are driven by money, right? They want to extort, they want to hold your data at ransom, they want to do something of that kind. And they want to go undetected, because the longer they are in your network, you know, the longer they can leverage whatever. I don't think that the human analyst is ever going to be completely out of the loop. The only thing we can do is help the human analyst, which is, by the way, why we are called CyberSift, because we sift through millions of events every day to give the customer those alerts that they need to take some action on. Sometimes even we take the action on behalf of the customer.
So how do they get into the system?
They can get in through various methods. So one way is a phishing attack, right? Or a smishing, right? You get some link on an SMS. Hey, your FedEx is coming to Malta, pay a euro or something like that, and you click a link to put in your credentials or whatever, or you receive an email and to see the content, they expect you to log into your cloud email account, not to mention any providers. That website would be fake, but they're collecting your credentials to use them against you. One that we're seeing more often is they send you to a website, and what they try to steal from your computer are these session cookies. What a session cookie does, just to explain. You know, when you log into a website, the first time you put in your username and password and maybe your multi-factor, yes. If you scroll away and scroll back, it doesn't ask you again because you've recently logged in. What's actually controlling that is a little file called a cookie in your browser. So if I manage to steal that little file from your computer, all of a sudden I can impersonate you. What we're finding out more and more is that very often when you create an account for work or whatever, it asks you for an alternate email address just in case you get logged out. Usually it's your personal email address this time, right? So if I actually get to your personal providers, but potentially if I breach your personal email account, I could actually reset your work email address or your work VPN access or other credentials, right? So what they want to do is the first time is trick you into taking an action to divulge that information. Then the second step is either the same attacker will use those credentials against you, but more often than not, these credentials that work are sold on the dark web by what they call access brokers. So they know they have access to a particular network, but they have no use for it. They package them together, and then they sell them on to somebody who will use them for an attack. This goes on.
Right. Saying is they can either do it because of money, so they would be asking you for money down the line, or they sell your data.
Yes, so in this case, what I'm referring to as they're selling the credentials, right? They're selling the access.
Yes.
The selling the data comes at a second stage. So they've got into your network now because they have a valid credential. Usually they try to escalate their privileges. Everybody wants to become an administrator because the administrator has full control of everything. And then they go after the data. What they normally do is either they exfiltrate the data, so they take a copy outside of your network and then lock you out of your own data by encrypting it, Or they delete everything and basically, you know, they call you or they send you an email or whatever saying, listen, we've deleted all your data, we have a copy. Or you have something compromising, if you're an individual or whatever, and they say, listen, if you're not going to give us money, we're going to tell the world that you've been on XYZ website or whatever you've done, you know. So it's extortion.
Yes.
Now, it could be extortion because of reputation or for you know, to diminish your reputation or other means. Others will have other motives, you know. They'll want to compromise your network to then launch other attacks to seem as though they're coming out of Malta rather than coming out of their own country, you know. So they're using your infrastructure to do other attacks down the line. Worst is you could be an IT supplier of sorts. So you could be offering a service to another organization. They first attack you, and then from you, they hop on to your customer. That is very, there were some big cases of that.
I think, you know, at university, to a very, very small extent now, people, academics, of course, who, you know, publish papers, you know, in journals. And very often, you know, I receive emails from my point of view, you know, asking, would you like to, you know, send in your manuscript, you know, to be published? And very often these emails, when I look at them, I start to question, how did they get hold of my data? And, you know, I really have to ask to find out whether this is genuine or not. And sometimes you pick these things up, you know, you realize that this email somehow is not quite the correct format, or the editor is not clear, and sometimes, but many of us might actually fall into this trap. How does one go about avoiding such a situation?
Unfortunately, we've entered the era of don't trust and verify, where before we used to trust and verify. You know, now we're literally in the opposite thing. You know, everything from social media to an email. Is you should basically start from the point of it's probably a scam, and move from there. If you don't know the person, if you've never met the person face to face, or you don't have a relationship with that person, and they have your contact, it's probably a scam. And you need to work, unfortunately, because the world is becoming what it is, from that point of view. Academics have a particular problem because in reality you're creating IP. And IP has value. Suffice to say that all the stuff, all the tech that is in our products, we didn't invent. There are papers, published academic papers. Sometimes you find that the author left out some of the secret sauce, now on purpose or not, but they don't give the whole thing away, but they give enough for them to be published, right? And then we have to go away and develop the rest ourselves. But you have already a very good footing. Like our company is becoming valuable because of the IP. Other areas of technology can benefit. You know, I know that at university there's a whole IP department, for example.
Yes, yes. Okay, so now talking about, you know, business strategy and growth, you know, and Malta, like, is not traditionally seen as a global cybersecurity hub. What advantages and challenges has the local ecosystem presented to CyberSift?
I would tell you that, like, I know of two cases, two other companies. In fact, I would advise you to have the founders of one of them on your program. Have been very successful in that. In fact, they've been eventually bought by big multinationals, you know, and they were not too far from university, unless they were already here, I don't know. So we're definitely not the first to do this. Malta's a good proving ground. You know, you can easily have your 5-6 meetings a day, business meeting, you know, sales meetings with customers, and if you get a good reputation, your reputation quickly spreads. So in fact, you know, in the financial services space, almost we won a couple of deals, and all of a sudden others fell in line. You know, it works like that. But there are some cases, you know, where the Maltese mentality, in my opinion, is a bit wrong for entrepreneurship. Although a prima facie, they'll tell you, you know, yes, Malta's all for innovation, yeah, we want to help local industry and all. But if a foreign company were to come to Malta with the same offering, the doors would be wider open than a Maltese company or Maltese opening the door for another Maltese kind of thing. We almost like to be colonized all the time. I don't know if I'm portraying this correctly, but it's hard. It's easier to sell to a foreigner abroad rather than to sell to your own people. You know, if you're good, you have to be twice as good in Malta.
Okay, this is a cultural.
Yeah, cultural. If I had to tell you what is the biggest stumbling block for us, it's that. Go to Israel, for example. It's complete, or Japan. It's completely the other way. First, we will consume your product here. We will help you grow it. And then we'll also help you to internationalize it. Here with us in Malta, it's the other way.
I see. Okay, so how did you attract your first major clients? And what did that process teach you about selling cybersecurity solutions?
So teach you, I think we're learning right up until today.
How many people are you?
We're just under 30.
Under 30, no. Okay.
So learning, we're learning every day. And now we are at a point where some companies are engaging what they call ethical hackers themselves to test their own defenses. In the financial services space, they're doing something called threat-led penetration testing, which is a three-month-long attack. Effectively, and there's no scope in the sense, come and attack whatever you can, walk into the building, attack my Wi-Fi, attack my website. So they're literally bombarding us with attacks. And our guys need to be on their toes. So this is why we're constantly learning. So they're upping the ante on us.
All right.
About selling, first you have to sell yourself. You're basically, because you're an unknown quantity. In fact, initially our meetings used to start by the customer saying, so who are you exactly? What do you do? So only now, 8 years later, does that question not come up anymore. So at that point, you know, when you're starting out, it's your commitment to the project and the customer that sells, not actually the product, because he hasn't seen it.
Okay. So your emphasis on a fast return on investment for clients, how would you demonstrate measurable impact in cybersecurity?
I would tell you that of all the customers we have, none had to increase the complement of security staff. So they've basically hived it off to us. Now in Malta, it's extremely hard to find cybersecurity resources who actually know their stuff. And I cannot think of one customer that has engaged us but also needed to employ people. So okay. There's your return on it. And we cost less than a salary of one employee. So.
Okay, so let's talk about the culture now of CyberSift. What kind of culture are you building in your company, you know, especially in a field where talent is both scarce and highly competitive?
In order for us to have the people we want, so we have a security operations team who are half the company effectively. And they are, you've mentioned the countries before, they are the resources in those countries. We have a 24-hour operation. So some customers have asked us to be on alert 24 hours a day. And we've adopted the model of follow the sun. So when Europe is getting to the evening, we have a colleague, for example, who is French, but lives in Brazil because he's married to a Brazilian lady. So he comes online later on in the day. As he's switching off, other countries come online and so on until we cover the 24/7. We are also in the process of recruiting in India. One part I didn't tell you or we didn't mention is that we've attracted an investment from a client, which is a large telco here. So the client now became a partner, and they also have a big centered, or they have their own building and stuff in India as well. And they're telling us, you know, why don't you use our premises there as a center for recruitment? So you have Italians, Maltese, Estonian, British, Bulgarian. So everybody has their nuances culture-wise, you know. These people meet maybe once a year if we do an event and bring them all to one place. And it's more about the cause rather than anything else. You know, our logo is a shield. And we try to instill, listen, guys, we are the, and ladies, because there are ladies now, we are the protectors of the customer. So this is what really unites us. But in reality, there are different religions and different cultures and different schools of thought. And some have young kids, some have older kids. It's unfortunate that we're not all in one building. But that's, you know, the modern way kind of thing now.
It must be difficult then to really feel the culture of the company now.
It is harder. It is harder. Okay. In fact, we are investing also a lot in HR and you know, staff well-being and so on. And not easy.
No, I'm sure it isn't. And with all the different cultures, even then must be a bit more challenging for people who are coming from Asia.
Really difficult. And I, you know, a SOC operations person, the closest I can imagine is that, like, stockbroking, you know, investing, where you're effectively looking at data and graphs all day. And, you know, a spike in something... In the financial world, you're selling or buying, right? Over here, if there's a spike, probably someone's getting hacked. So you need to keep these people motivated and alert. Because, by the way, if you're, I don't know, working from one of our centers abroad and you're half asleep, potentially someone's going to get hurt somewhere. Think about the girl with the cancer. You know, you need to be snappy and on the ball.
Okay. So how would you nurture innovation, you know, within your team? Especially when you're dealing with complex, high-stakes technology like AI and cybersecurity?
So the best solution we found, we have these chat rooms. So we have one of these cloud providers that offers, you know, chat rooms and so on. So there's a dedicated chat room for that. So all the people are there. We have a platform where, you know, we get the stuff to write articles and knowledge base and so on. And we make sure that they are authored, right? So if, let's say, Emmanuel writes a nice article, Emmanuel being one of the analysts, who's Maltese, by the way, he, you know, he gets recognized by the rest of the company that he's you know, done well and that kind of thing. Obviously, there are the what I call the petty things, you know, salaries and bonuses and whatnot. But I'm talking about Emmanuel because recently he caught a hacker in a customer's network, who basically this hacker created a fake cloud account from the same provider that the customer was using, and he used this fake account that the hacker created, right, to attack the customer. So when you're looking at it, you're going, but this can't be malicious, it's coming from the same provider kind of thing. You know, you have to really scratch your head. Anyway, and he wrote a really good article about what he did and how he caught him and what he did and how he alerted the customer and so on. Customer being an international chain of hotels, by the way. So if their email goes down, there's no reservations coming in. So big, big thing. And, you know, you need to make almost a bigger fuss. You know, when you're in theater, they tell you everything needs to be a bit exaggerated because you're on stage kind of thing. And because these teams are remote, you know, we basically need to exaggerate them a bit more than they ought to recognize the individuals.
What are the consequences of something like this?
I know we've seen. Let's talk about something that was in the public domain, right? In the news, there was recently a hospital that got hacked, a private hospital that offered services even to the government hospitals, right? When something like that happens. Blood tests don't happen, radiology tests don't happen, MRIs don't happen, you know, patients who are suspected of being ill can't get their tests done, treatments are delayed, there could be life life-threatening consequences. So it's not, you know, just in the digital domain anymore. By the way, we still get the script kiddies. Script kiddies are the amateur hackers who use software they download to try to do something funny, you know, almost experiment. Those are the noisy ones, we call them. We're not really concerned about those. I mean, although those are, you know, you just block their IP address and you're done, we're more concerned with the pros.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And I mean, I understood what the consequences are for the hacking, but what are the consequences for the hackers?
There is a whole debate about the importance of incident response. So incident response is where you'd get a specialist come in and he will, you know, take images of all the computers and stuff and try to, in hindsight, which is, by the way, easier, piece together what happened and how this hacker got in. But if you're dealing with somebody who's attacking you from another compromised PC, so you're seeing an attack maybe coming from country A, but actually that country A computer was actually hacked and the guy is actually in country B, and you're basically going to the cybercrime unit with this evidence, there isn't much they can do. You know, so there isn't really much ramification. On the other hand, I was called on a case the year before, where a company sent €3.3 million to the wrong bank account. At least there, you know, they got the police involved. The police contacted international agencies. The bank did its own bit and blocked the funds because they saw this big amount of money coming in and whatnot. And the funds were recuperated.
Right.
So there are different outcomes, you know.
Okay. So if I had to talk now about the future of cybersecurity and AI, looking ahead, how do you see AI changing the cybersecurity industry over the next 5 years?
Definitely faster, and we need to be faster. Mm-hmm. So we have customers who are sending to our systems up to 2 terabytes a day of data. That is a huge amount of data. The analyst, the human analyst, needs to have only what is super, super critical, escalated to him. So here you're talking about lightning speed detections. Like, we are leveraging AI, so are the bad guys. Mm-hmm. You know, from crafting the phishing emails right up to the writing of malware and so on. And eventually it's going to become a fight of good AI against bad AI. That's about it. With the humans being the controllers of, if you have to take an analogy in the physical world, think about what's going on with drones. So people used to play down the value of drones. Look at the Ukraine-Russian war, where, you know, these drones have taken front and center stage and are crippling tanks and whatnot, right? And this is, you know, AI at that point was being thought of the next search engine, but it's going to be much more than that.
Okay. What do you think are the new threats, that businesses in Malta may face and beyond, you know, that they should be concerned about in the coming decade?
Business email compromise is definitely the first one. It's already prevalent. It will keep happening even more. So somebody is in the part of your email, somewhere in the middle, and is receiving your emails and monitoring them. Either to, at one point, you know, steal money, or for some later access to do something else. I think that is going to start to become more and more important and will be one of the things we need to keep an eye on. The other one is that I don't believe that we have enough resilience as a nation, keep in mind being an island as well, that, you know, if some nation state had to come to attack Malta properly, we'd survive. I don't think we'll stand a chance.
Okay. So just to mention, make reference to the first point, are you saying that hackers can actually be part, for example, of my system and remain there for months, ready to attack when they think is possible?
100%. They were even inside the networks of banks, and they had gone undetected. You know, 2019, a local bank got money stolen, as you know.
Yes.
The hackers weren't in and out in one day. They were there for months.
I see.
Look up the news of the time, and that is no slouch of a bank. You know, they have invested heavily in cybersecurity.
So I can understand banks why people would try to hack the system because of money. Mm-hmm. But why would you hack medical records?
I can halt the hospital's operations until they pay me.
I see. So that's where the financial gain
is. I can look up who has HIV, for example, and target those individuals, telling them that, listen, I know you have HIV, you're probably of some sexual orientation or other, and send me money or I'm going to expose you.
I see.
All manner of things, you know.
Right. So if you could summarize CyberSIFT's journey in one sentence, what would it be?
The company that will continue innovating until its last day, I would say.
Okay. Student Spotlight. Mm-hmm. If I had to ask what advice you would give to students who dream of starting their own tech company one day, what would you advise?
Make sure that it is in an area that you have a passion for. If you're not passionate about it, it's going to fail.
And if I had to ask you, looking back, what skills or mindset do you think are most important for young people entering cybersecurity today?
Skills, definitely software development and IT infrastructure. So you need to know first the nuts and bolts before you jump into something as sophisticated as this.
And the mindset?
Mindset, you have to be inquisitive, always wanting to learn more.
Okay, well, that is all the time we have for today's program. I wish to thank our guest, Brian Zarpadami, CEO and co-founder, CyberSIFT, for taking time out to accept our invitation. I would also like to thank Mark Atius for the technical assistance of this program. Thank you so much for tuning in to Business Frontiers in Malta. I am Anne-Marie Teig from the University of Malta, and it's been a pleasure spending this time with you.